"We have orders." Vin was looking over the dispatch the captain had delivered. "Well, the Americans wanted to come here, eh? I hope they do. This will be no Song Tae for them." The idea of an infantry action didn't exactly thrill Colonel Grishinov, and a trip to Hanoi, even an unannounced one, also meant a trip to the embassy. "Let me pack, Major." "Be quick about it," the little man snapped back, wondering if his trip to Hanoi was for some manner of transgression. It could be worse. Grishinov now had all his notes together and slid them into a backpack. All of his work, now that Vin had so kindly released it back to him. He'd drop it off with General Rokossovsky, and with that in official hands, he could make his case for keeping these Americans alive. It was an ill wind, he thought, remembering the English aphorism. He could hear them coming, far off, moving without a great deal of skill, probably tired, but coming. "Cricket, this is Snake, over." "We read you, Snake." "I'm moving. There are people on my hill coming my way. I will head west. Can you send a helo for me?" "Affirmative. Be careful, son." It was Maxwell's voice, still concerned. "Moving now. Out." Kelly pocketed the radio and headed to the crest. He took a moment to look, comparing what he saw now with what he'd seen before. "I run especially fast in the dark," he'd told the Marines. "Time now to prove it." With one last listen to the approaching NVA, Kelly picked a thin spot in the foliage and headed down the hill. Chapter 30. Travel Agents. It was obvious to everyone that things were wrong. The two rescue helos touched down on Ogden not an hour after they'd left. One was wheeled aside at once. The other, flown by the senior pilot, was refueled. Captain Albee was out almost the second it landed, sprinting to the superstructure, where the command team was waiting for him. He could feel that Ogden and her escorts were racing into the beach. His dejected Marines trailed out as well, silent, looking down at the flight deck as they cleared their weapons. "What happened?" Albee asked.
"Clark waved it off. All we know is that he's moved off his hill. He said other people were there. We're going to try to get him out."
"Where do you think he'll go?" Maxwell asked.
"He'll look for a place the helo can get him. Let's see the map."
Had he had the time to reflect, Kelly might have considered how quickly things could go from good to bad. But he didn't. Survival was an all-encompassing game, and at the moment it was also the only game in town. Certainly it wasn't a boring one, and with luck not overly demanding. There weren't all that many troops for the purpose of securing the camp against an assault. Not enough, yet, to conduct real defensive patrols. If they were worried about another Song Tae-type mission, they'd keep their firepower in close. They'd put observation teams on hilltops, probably nothing more than that, at least for the moment. The top of Snake Hill was now 500 meters in his wake. Kelly slowed his descent, catching his breath. He was more winded from fear than effort, though the two traded off heavily against each other. He found a secondary crest and rested on the far side of it. Standing still now, he could hear talk behind him. Talk, not movement. Okay, good. He'd guessed right on the tactical situation. Probably more troops would be arriving in due course, but he'd be long gone by then. If they can get that helo in. Pleasant thought. I've been in tighter spots than this, Defiance proclaimed. When? Pessimism inquired delicately. The only thing that made sense at the moment was to put as much distance as possible between himself and the NVA. Next came the necessity of finding something approximating an LZ so that he could get the hell out of this place. It wasn't a time to panic, but he couldn't dally either. Come daylight, there would be more troops here. And if their commander was a competent one, he'd want to know if there might be an enemy reconnaissance element on his turf. Failure to get out before dawn would materially degrade Kelly's chances of ever escaping this country. Move. Find a good spot. Call the helo. Get the hell out of here. He had 4 hours until dawn. The helo was about 30 minutes away. Make it 2 or 3 hours to find a spot and make the call. That didn't seem overly difficult. He knew the area around Sender Green from the recon photos.
Kelly took a few minutes to look around, orienting himself. The quickest way to a clear spot was that way, across a twist in the road. It was a gamble, but a good one. He rearranged his load, moving his spare magazines within easier reach. More than anything else, Kelly feared capture, to be at the mercy of men like Plastic Flower, to be unable to fight back, to lose control of his life. A quiet little voice in the back of his mind told him that death was preferred to that. Fighting back, even against impossible odds, wasn't suicide. Okay, that was decided. He started moving.
"Call him?" Maxwell asked.
"No, not now." Captain Alby shook his head. "He'll call us. Mr. Clark is busy right now. We leave him be." Irvin came into the Combat Information Center.
"Clark?" the Master Gunnery Sergeant asked.
"On the run," Alby told him.
"Want me and some people on Rescue One riding shotgun?"
That they would try to get Clark out was not a question. Marines have an institutional loathing of leaving people behind.
"My job, Irvin," Alby said.
"Better you run the rescue, sir," Irvin said reasonably. "Anybody can shoot a rifle." Maxwell, Podolsky, and Greer stayed out of the conversation, watching and listening to two professionals who knew what they were about. The Marine commander bent to the wisdom of his most senior NCO.
"Take what you need."
Alby turned to Maxwell.
"Sir, I want Rescue One up now."
The Assistant Chief of Naval Operations, Air, handed over the headset to a Marine officer only 28 years old. With it came tactical command of the busted mission. With it went the end of Dutch Maxwell's career. It was less fearful to be moving. Movement gave Kelly the feeling that he had control of his life. It was an illusion, and intellectually he knew it. But his body took the message that way, which made things better. He got to the bottom of the hill into thicker growth. There. Right across the road was an open space, a meadow or something. Maybe a floodplain area from the river. That would do just fine. Nothing fancy. He grabbed his radio.
"Snake to Cricket, over."
"This is Cricket. We read you, and we are standing by." The message came in gasps, spoken one short breath at a time. "West of my hill. Past the road. About 2 miles west of objective. Open field. I'm close. Send the helo. I can mark with strobe." Alby looked at the map, then the aerial photos. Okay, that looked easy enough. He stabbed a finger on the map, and the air control petty officer relayed the information at once. Alby waited for the confirmation before transmitting back to Clark.
"Roger, copy. Rescue One is moving in now, 20 minutes away."
"Copy that." Alby could hear the relief in Clark's voice through the static.
"I'll be ready. Out."
"Thank you, God." Kelly took his time now, moving slowly and quietly towards the road. His second sojourn into North Vietnam wouldn't end up being as long as the first. He didn't have to swim out this time. And with all the shots he'd gotten before coming in, maybe this time he wouldn't be getting sick from the water in that goddamned river. He didn't so much relax as lose some of his tension. As though on cue, the rain picked up, dampening noise and reducing visibility. More good news. Maybe God or fate or the Great Pumpkin hadn't decided to curse him after all. He stopped again, 10 meters short of the road, and looked around. Nothing. He gave himself a few minutes to relax and let the stress bleed off. There was no sense in hurrying across just to be in open ground. Open ground was dangerous for a man alone in enemy territory. His hands were tight on his carbine, the infantryman's teddy bear, as he forced himself to breathe deeply and slowly in order to bring his heart rate down. When he felt approximately normal again, he allowed himself to approach the road.
Miserable roads, Grishinov thought. Even worse than those in Russia.
The car was something French, oddly enough. More remarkably, it ran fairly well, or would have done so except for the driver. Major Vin ought to have driven it himself. As an officer, he probably knew how. But status-conscious fool that he was, he had to let his orderly do it. And this little lump of a peasant probably didn't know how to drive anything more complicated than an ox. The car was swerving in the mud. The driver was having trouble seeing in the rain as well. Grishinov closed his eyes in the rear seat, clutching his backpack. No sense watching. It might just scare him to watch. It was like flying in bad weather, he thought, something no pilot relished, even less so when someone else was in control. He waited, looking before crossing, listening for the sound of a truck's engine, which was the greatest danger to him. Nothing. Okay, about 5 minutes on the helo now. Kelly stood erect, reaching back with his left hand for the marker strobe. As he crossed the road, he kept looking to his left, the route that additional troop trucks would take to approach the now entirely secure prison camp. Damn. Rarely had concentration ever worked against John Kelly, but it did this time. The sound of the approaching car, swishing through the muddy surface of the road, was a little too close to the environmental noises, and by the time he recognized the difference, it was too late. When the car came around the bend, he was right in the middle of the road, standing there like a deer in the headlights, and surely the driver must see him. What followed was automatic. Kelly brought his carbine up and fired a short burst into the driver's area. The car didn't swerve for a moment, and he laid a second burst into the front passenger seat. The car changed directions then, slamming directly into a tree. The entire sequence could not have taken 3 seconds, and Kelly's heart started beating again after a dreadfully long hiatus. He ran to the car. Whom had he killed? The driver had come through the windshield, 2 rounds in his brain. Kelly wrenched open the passenger door. The person there was the Major, also hit in the head. The shots weren't quite centered, and though the man's skull was opened on the right side, his body was still quivering. Kelly yanked him out of the vehicle and had knelt down to search him before he heard a groan from the inside. He lunged inside, finding another man, Russian, on the floor in the rear. Kelly pulled him out, too. The man had a backpack clutched in his hands. The routine came as automatically as the shot. Kelly clubbed the Russian to full unconsciousness with his buttstock, then quickly turned back to rifle the Major's uniform for intelligence material. He stuffed all documents and papers into his pockets. The Vietnamese was looking at him, one of his eyes still functioning. "Life's a bitch, ain't it?" Kelly said coldly as the eyes lost their animation. "What the hell do I do with you?" Kelly asked, turning to the Russian body. "You're the guy who's been hassling our guys, aren't you?" He knelt there, opening the backpack and finding whole sheaves of paper, which answered his question for him, something the Soviet colonel was singularly unable to do. "Think fast, John. The helo isn't very far out now." "I got the strobe," the co-pilot said. "Coming in hot." The pilot was driving his Sikorsky as hard as the engines would allow. 200 yards short of the clearing, he pulled back sharply on the cyclic, and the 45-degree nose-up attitude stopped forward motion quickly. Perfectly, in fact, as he leveled out within feet of the blinking infrared strobe light. The rescue helicopter came to a steady hover 2 feet over the deck, buffeted by the winds. The Navy commander was fighting all manner of forces to hold his aircraft steady, and was slow to respond to something his eyes had told him. He had seen the rotor wash knock his intended survivor down, but... "Did I see 2 people out there?" he asked over the intercom. "Go, go, go," another voice said over the IC circuit. "Packs aboard now, go!" "Getting the hell out of Dodge City now!" The pilot pulled collective for altitude, kicked rudder pedal, and dropped his nose, heading back to the river as the helicopter accelerated. "Wasn't there just supposed to be 1 person?" He set it aside. He had to fly now, and it was 30 twisty miles to the water and safety. "Who the fuck is this?" Irvin asked. "Hitchhiker," Kelly answered over the din of the engines. He shook his head. Explanations would be lengthy and would have to wait. Irvin understood, offering him a canteen. Kelly drained it. That's when the shaking started. In front of the helicopter crew and 5 Marines, Kelly shivered like a man in the Arctic, huddling and clutching himself, holding his weapon close until Irvin took it away and cleared it. It had been fired, the master gunnery sergeant saw. Later he'd find out why and at what. The door gunners scanned the river valley while their aircraft screamed out, barely 100 feet over the meandering surface. The ride proved uneventful, far different from what they had expected, as was the case with this whole night. What had gone wrong, they all wanted to know. The answer was in the man they'd just picked up. But who the hell was the other one? And wasn't that a Russian uniform? Two Marines sat over him. One of them tied his hands up. A third secured the pack's flap in place with the straps.
Rescue One, feet wet. We have Snake aboard, over.
Rescue One, this is Cricket. Roger, copy that. Standing by, out.
Albie looked up.
Well, that's it. Podolsky took it the hardest of all. Boxwood Green had been his idea from the start. Had it been successful, it might have changed everything. It might have opened the door for certain Cornet, might have changed the course of the war, and his son's death would not have been for nothing. He looked up at the others. He almost asked if they might still try it again, but he knew better. Washout. It was a bitter concept, and an even more bitter reality for one who had served his adopted country for nearly 30 years.
Tough day, Frank Allen asked.
Lieutenant Mark Charon was surprisingly chipper for a man who'd been through a fatal shooting and the almost as rigorous interrogation that had followed it.
The damn fool. Didn't have to happen that way, Charon said.
I guess he didn't like the idea of life on Falls Road, the narcotics division lieutenant added, referring to the Maryland State Penitentiary. Located in downtown Baltimore, the building was so grim that its inmates referred to it as Frankenstein's Castle. Allen didn't have to tell him much. The procedures for the incident were straightforward. Charon would go on administrative leave for 10 working days while the department made sure that the shooting had not been contrary to official policy guidelines for the use of deadly force. It was essentially a 2-week vacation with pay, except that Charon might have to face additional interviews. Not likely in this case, as several police officers had observed the whole thing, one from a mere 20 feet away.
"I've got the case, Mark," Allen told him. "I've been over the preliminaries. Looks like you'll come out okay on this. Anything you might have done to spook him?"
Charon shook his head.
"No, I didn't shout or anything until he went for his piece. I tried to ease him into it, you know, calm him down like. But he just jumped the wrong way."
Eddie Morello died of the dumbs, the lieutenant observed, impassively enjoying the fact that he was telling the exact truth.
"Well, I'm not going to cry over the death of a doper. Good day all around, Mark."
"How's that, Frank?" Charon sat down and stole a cigarette.
"Got a call from Pittsburgh today. Seems there may be a witness for the Fountain murder that Em and Tom are handling."
"No shit, that's good news. What do we have?"
"Somebody, probably a girl from how the guy was talking, who saw Madden and Waters get it. Sounds like she's talking to her minister about it, and he's trying to coax her into opening up."
"Great," Charon observed, concealing his inward chill as well as he'd hid his elation at his first contract murder. "One more thing to clean up. With luck, that would be the end of it." The helicopter flared and made a soft landing on USS Ogden. As soon as it was down, people came back out on the flight deck. Deck crewmen secured the aircraft in place with chains while they approached. The Marines came out first, relieved to be safe, but also bitterly disappointed at the way the night had turned out. The timing was nearly perfect, they knew. This was their programmed time to return to the ship with their rescued comrades, and they'd looked forward to this moment as a sports team might anticipate the joys of a winning locker room. But not now. They'd lost, and they still didn't know why. Irvin and another Marine climbed out, holding a body, which really surprised the assembled flag officers as Kelly alighted next. The helicopter pilot's eyes grew wide as he watched. There had been 2 bodies in the meadow. But mainly he was relieved at achieving another semi-successful rescue mission into North Vietnam.
"What the hell?" Maxwell asked as the ship commenced a turn to the east.
Guys, let's get this guy inside and isolated right now," Ritter said.
"He's unconscious, sir."
"Then get a medic, too," Ritter ordered. They picked one of Ogden's many empty troop berthing spaces for the debrief. Kelly was allowed to wash his face, but nothing else. A medical corpsman checked out the Russian,
pronounced him dazed but healthy. Both pupils equal and reactive, no concussion. A pair of Marines stood guard over him. Four trucks, Kelly said. They just drove right in. A reinforced platoon. Weapons platoon, probably. They showed up while the assault team was inbound. Started digging in right away. About 50 of them. I had to blow it off. Greer and Ritter traded a look. No coincidence. Kelly looked at Maxwell. God, I'm sorry, sir. He paused. It would not have been possible to execute the mission. I had to leave the hill because they were putting listening posts out. I mean, even if we were able to deal with that... We had gunships, remember? Podolsky growled. Back off, Kaz, James Greer warned. Kelly looked long at the Admiral before responding to the accusation. Admiral, the chances of success were exactly zero. You guys gave me the job of eyeballing the objective so that we could do it on the cheap, right? With more assets, maybe we could have done it. The Songtay team could have done it. It would have been messy, but they had enough firepower to bring it off, coming right into the objective like they did. He shook his head again. Not this way. You're sure? Maxwell asked. Kelly nodded. Yes, sir. Sure as hell. Thank you, Mr. Clark, Captain Albee said quietly, knowing the truth of what he'd just heard. Kelly just sat there, still tensed from the night's events. Okay, Ritter said after a moment. What about our guest, Mr. Clark? I fucked up, Kelly admitted, explaining how the car had gotten so close. He reached into his pockets. I killed the driver and the camp commander. I think that's what he was. He had all this on him. Kelly reached into his pockets and handed over the documents. Lots of papers on the Russian. I figured it wasn't smart to leave him there. I thought he might be useful to us. These papers are in Russian, Irvin announced. Give me some, Ritter ordered. My Russian's pretty good. We need somebody who can read Vietnamese, too. I have one of those, Albee said. Irvin, get Sergeant Chalmers in here. Aye, aye, sir. Ritter and Greer moved to a corner table. Lord, the field officer observed, flipping through the written notes. This guy's gotten a lot. Rokossovsky. He's in Hanoi. Here's a summary sheet. Staff Sergeant Chalmers, an intelligence specialist, started reading through the papers taken from Major Vinh. Everyone else waited for the spooks to get through the papers. Where am I? Grishinov asked in Russian. He tried to reach for his blindfold, but his hands couldn't move. How are you feeling? A voice answered in the same language. Car smashed into something. The voice stopped. Where am I? You're aboard USS Ogden, Colonel, Ritter told him in English. The body strapped in the bunk went rigid, and the prisoner immediately said in Russian that he didn't speak English. Then why are some of your notes in English? Ritter asked reasonably. I am a Soviet officer. You have no right. We have as much right as you had to interrogate American prisoners of war and to conspire to kill them, Comrade Colonel. What do you mean? Your friend Major Vinh is dead, but we have his dispatches. I guess you were finished talking to our people, right? And the NVA were trying to figure the most convenient way to eliminate them. Are you telling me you didn't know that? The oath Ritter heard was a particularly vile one, but the voice held genuine surprise that was interesting. This man was too injured to dissimulate well. He looked up at Greer. I've got some more reading to do. You want to keep this guy company? The one good thing that happened to Kelly that night was that Captain Franks hadn't tossed the aviator rations over the side after all. Finished with his debrief, he found his cabin and downed three stiff ones. With the release from the tension of the night, physical exhaustion assaulted the young man. The three drinks knocked him out, and he collapsed into his bunk without so much as a cleansing shower. It was decided that Ogden would continue as planned, steaming at 20 knots back toward Subic Bay. The big amphibious ship became a quiet place. The crew, pumped up for an important and dramatic mission, became subdued with its failure. Watches were changed. The ship continued to function as before. but the mess room's only noise was that of the metal trays and utensils. No jokes, no stories. The additional medical personnel took it the hardest of all. With no one to treat and nothing to do, they just wandered about. Before noon, the helicopters departed, the Cobras for Da Nang and the rescue birds back to their carrier. The signal intelligence people switched over to more regular duties, searching the airways for radio messages, finding a new mission to replace the old. Kelly didn't awaken until 1800 hours. After showering, he headed below to find the Marines. He owed them an explanation, he thought. Somebody did. They were in the same space. The sand table model was still there as well. "I was right up here," he said, finding the rubber band with two eyes on it. "How many bad guys?"
4 trucks. They came in this road. Stopped here," Kelly explained. "They were digging in crew-served weapons here and here. They sent people up my hill. I saw another team heading this way right before I moved."
"Jesus," the squad leader noted. "Right on our approach route."
"Yeah," Kelly confirmed. "Anyway, that's why." "How'd they know to send in the reinforcements?" a corporal asked.
"Not my department."
"Thanks, Snake," the squad leader said, looking from the model that would soon be tossed over the side. "Tough call, wasn't it?" Kelly nodded.
"I'm sorry, pal. Jesus God, I'm sorry.
Mr. Clark, I got a baby due in 2 months. Except for you, well..." The Marine extended his hand across the model.
"Thank you, sir." Kelly took it.
"Mr. Clark, sir?" A sailor stuck his head into the compartment. "The admirals are looking for you. Up in officer country, sir."
"Dr. Rosen," Sam said, lifting the phone.
"Hi, doctor. This is Sergeant Douglas."
"What can I do for you?"
"We're trying to track down your friend Kelly. He isn't answering his phone. Do you have any idea where he is?"
"I haven't seen him in a long time," the surgeon said guardedly.
"You know anybody who has?"
"I'll check around."
"What's the story?" Sam added, asking what he knew might be a highly inconvenient question, wondering what sort of answer he might get.
I can't say, sir. I hope you understand."
"Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, I'll ask."
"Feeling better?" Ritter asked first.
"Some," Kelly allowed.
"What's the story on the Russian?"
"Clark, you just might have done something useful."
Ritter gestured to a table with no fewer than 10 piles of documents on them.
"They're planning to kill the prisoners," Greer said.
"Who, the Russians?" Kelly asked.
"The Vietnamese. The Russians want them alive."
"This guy you picked up is trying to take them home," Ritter said, lifting a sheet of paper. "Here's his draft of the letter justifying it."
"Is that good or bad?"
The outside noises were different, Zacharias thought. More of them, too. Shouts with purpose to them, though he didn't know what purpose. For the first day in a month, Grishinov hadn't visited him, even for a few minutes. The loneliness he felt became even more acute, and his only company was the realization that he'd given to the Soviet Union a graduate-level course in continental air defense. He hadn't meant to do it. He hadn't even known what he was doing. That was no consolation, however. The Russian had played him for a fool, and Colonel Robin Zacharias, USAF, had just given it all up, outsmarted by some kindness and fellowship from an atheist, and drink. Stupidity and sin, such a likely combination of human weaknesses, and he'd done it all. He didn't even have tears for his shame. He was beyond that, sitting on the floor of his cell, staring at the rough, dirty concrete between his bare feet. He'd broken faith with his God and his country, Zacharias told himself, as his evening meal was pushed through the slot at the bottom of his door. Thin, bodiless pumpkin soup and maggoty rice. He made no move towards it. Grishinov knew he was a dead man. They wouldn't give him back. They couldn't even admit that they had him. He'd disappear, as other Russians in Vietnam had disappeared, some at SAM sites,
some doing other things for those ungrateful little bastards. Why were they feeding him so well? It had to be a large ship, but it was also his first time at sea. Even the decent food was hard to get down, but he swore not to disgrace himself by succumbing to motion sickness mixed with fear. He was a fighter pilot, a good one who had faced death before, mainly at the controls of a malfunctioning aircraft. He remembered wondering at the time what they'd tell his marina. He wondered now. A letter? What? Would his family be looked after by his fellow officers in PV Ostrania? Would the pension be sufficient? Are you kidding me? Mr. Clark, the world can be a very complicated place. Why did you think the Russians like them? They give them weapons and training, don't they? Ritter stubbed out his Winston. We give those things to people all over the world. They're not all nice folks, but we have to work with them. It's the same for the Russians. Maybe less so, but still pretty much the same. Anyway, this Grishinov guy was going to a considerable effort to keep our people alive. Ritter held up another sheet. Here's a request for better food, for a doctor even. So what do we do with him? Admiral Podolsky asked. That gentleman is our department, Ritter said, looking at Greer, who nodded. Wait a minute, Kelly objected. He was pumping them for information. So? Ritter asked. That was his job. We are getting away from the real issue here, Maxwell said. James Greer poured some coffee for himself. I know, we have to move fast. And finally, Ritter tapped a translation of the Vietnamese message. We know that somebody burned the mission. We're going to track that bastard down. Kelly was still too drugged from sleep to follow it all, much less see far enough into the future to realize how he had assumed his place in the center of the affair. Where's John? Sandy O'Toole looked up from her paperwork. It was close to the end of her shift, and Professor Rosen's question brought to the fore a worry that she'd managed to suppress for over a week. Out of the country? Why? I got a call today from the police. They're looking for him. Oh, God. Why? He didn't say. Rosen looked around. They were alone at the nurse's station. Sandy, I know he's been doing things. I mean, I think I know, but I haven't heard from him either. What are we supposed to do? Rosen grimaced and looked away before replying. As good citizens, we're supposed to cooperate with the police. But we're not doing that, are we? No idea where he is?
He told me, but I'm not supposed to... He's doing something with the government. Over in...
She couldn't finish. Couldn't bring herself to say the word.
He gave a number I can call. I haven't used it.
I would, Sam told her, and left. It wasn't right. He was off doing something scary and important, only to come back to a police investigation. It seemed to Nurse O'Toole that the unfairness of life had gotten as bad as it could. She was wrong.
Pittsburgh?
That's what he said, Henry confirmed.
It's cute, by the way, having him as your man on the inside.
Very professional, Piaggi said with respect.
He said we need to take care of it quick-like.
She hasn't said much yet.
She saw it all?
Piaggi didn't have to add that he didn't think that very professional at all.
Henry, keeping people in line is one thing. Making them into witnesses is another.
Tony, I'm going to take care of that, but we need to handle this problem right quick, you dig?
It seemed to Henry Tucker that he was in the stretch run, and over the finish line were both safety and prosperity. That five more people had to die to get him across that line was a small matter after the race he'd already run.
Go on.
The family name is Brown. Her name is Doris. Her father's name is Raymond.
You sure of this?
The girls talk to each other. I got the street name and everything. You got connections. I need you to use them fast.
Piaggi copied down the information.
Okay, our Philly connections can handle it. It's not going to be cheap, Henry.
I didn't expect it would be.
The flight deck looked very empty. All four of the aircraft briefly assigned to Ogden were gone now, and the deck reassumed its former status as the ship's unofficial town square. The stars were the same as before, now that the ship was again under clear skies, and a sliver of a waning moon was high in the sky in these early hours. No sailors were out now, however. Those awake at this hour were on duty, but for Kelly and the Marines the day-night cycle was askew, and the gray steel walls of their spaces were too confining for the thoughts they had. The ship's wake was a curious luminescent green from the photoplankton stirred up by the ship's screws, and left a long trail showing where she'd been. Half a dozen men stood well aft, staring at it without words. "It could have been a hell of a lot worse, you know." Kelly turned. It was Irvin. It had to be. "Could have been a hell of a lot better, too, Guns. Wasn't no accident, them showing up like that, was it?" "I don't think I'm supposed to say. Is that a good enough answer?" "Yes, sir. And Lord Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.'" "And what if they do know?" Irvin grunted. "I think you know what my vote is. Whoever it was, they could have killed all of us." "You know, Guns, just one time I'd like to finish something the right way," Kelly said. "Yeah." Irvin took a second before going on and going back. "Why the hell would anybody do something like that?" A shape loomed close. It was Newport News. A lovely silhouette only 2,000 yards off, and visible in a spectral way despite the absence of lights. She too was heading back, the last of the Navy's big gun cruisers, creature of a bygone age, returning home after the same failure that Kelly and Irvin knew. 7131, the female voice said.
"Hello, I'm trying to get Admiral James Greer," Sandy told the secretary.
"He's not in."
"Can you tell me when he'll be back?"
"Sorry, no, I don't know."
"But it's important."
"Could you tell me who's calling, please?"
"What is this place?"
"This is Admiral Greer's office."
"No, I mean, is it the Pentagon?"
"Don't you know?" Sandy didn't know, and that question led her off in a direction she didn't understand.
"Please, I need your help."
"Who's calling, please?"
"Please, I need to know where you are."
"I can't tell you that," the secretary responded, feeling herself to be one of the fortress walls that protected U.S. national security.
"Is this the Pentagon?"
Well, she could tell her that.
"No, it isn't."
"What then?" Sandy wondered. She took a deep breath.
"A friend of mine gave me this number to call. He's with Admiral Greer. He said I could call here to find out if he's okay."
"I don't understand."
"Look, I know he went to Vietnam."
"Miss, I cannot discuss where Admiral Greer is." "Who violated security? She'd have to make a report on this."
"It's not about him, it's about John."
"Calm down, you're not helping anyone this way."
"John who?" the secretary asked.
Deep breath. Swallow.
"Please get a message to Admiral Greer. This is Sandy. It's about John. He will understand, okay? He will understand. This is most important."
She gave her home and work numbers.
"Thank you. I will do what I can."
The line went dead. Sandy wanted to scream and nearly did so. So the Admiral had gone too. Okay, he'd be close to where John is. The secretary would get the message through. She would have to. People like that, if you said most important, didn't have the imagination not to do it. Settle down. Anyway, where he was, the police couldn't get him either. But for the rest of the day, and into the next, the second hand on her watch seemed to stand still. USS Ogden pulled into Subic Bay Naval Station in the early afternoon. Coming alongside seemed to take forever in the moist tropical heat. Finally, lines were tossed, and a brow advanced to the ship's side. A civilian sprinted up first, even before it was properly secured. Soon thereafter, the Marines filed off to a bus which would take them to QB Point. The deck division watched them walk off. A few hands were shaken as everyone tried to leave at least one good memory from the experience,
but good try just didn't make it, and good luck seemed blasphemous. Their C-141 was waiting there for the flight stateside. Mr. Clark, they saw, wasn't with them.
"John, it seems you have a lady friend who's worried about you," Greer said, handing the message over. It was the friendliest of the dispatches that the junior CIA officer had brought up from Manila. Kelly scanned it while three admirals reviewed the others.
"Do I have time to call her, sir? She's worried about me."
"You left her my office number?"
Greer was slightly vexed.
"Her husband was killed with the first cab, sir. She worries," Kelly explained.
"Okay." Kelly put his own troubles aside for the moment. "I'll have Barbara tell her you're safe." The rest of the messages were less welcome. Admirals Maxwell and Podolsky were being summoned back to Washington soonest to report on the failure of Boxwood Green. Ritter and Greer had similar orders, though they also had an ace in the hole. Their KC-135 was waiting at Clark Air Force Base. A puddle jumper would hop over the mountains. The best news at the moment was their disrupted sleep cycle. The flight back to the American East Coast would bring them back in just the right way. Colonel Grishinov came into the sunlight along with the admirals. He was wearing clothing borrowed from Captain Franks. They were of approximately the same size, and escorted by Maxwell and Podolsky. Collier was under no illusions of his chance to escape anywhere, not on an American naval base located on the soil of an American ally. Ritter was talking to him quietly, in Russian, as all six men walked down to the waiting cars. 10 minutes later, they climbed into an Air Force C-12 twin-prop Beechcraft. Half an hour later, that aircraft taxied right alongside the larger Boeing jet, which got off less than an hour after they'd left Ogden. Kelly found himself a nice wide seat and strapped himself in, asleep before the windowless transport started rolling. The next stop, they'd told him, was Hickam in Hawaii, and he didn't plan to be awake for any of that. Chapter 31. Home is the Hunter. The flight wasn't as restful for the others. Greer had managed to get a couple of messages taken care of before the takeoff, but he and Ritter were the busiest. Their aircraft, the Air Force had lent it to them for the mission, no questions asked, was a semi-VIP bird belonging to Andrews Air Force Base, and was often used for congressional junkets. That meant an ample supply of liquor, and while they drank straight coffee, their Russian guests' cups were laced with brandy, a little at first, then in increasing doses that his decaffeinated brew didn't begin to attenuate. Ritter handled most of the interrogation. His first task was to explain to Grishinov that they had no plans to kill him. Yes, they were CIA. Yes, Ritter was a field officer, a spy, if you like, with ample experience behind the Iron Curtain. Excuse me, working as a slinking spy in the peace-loving socialist East Bloc. But that was his job, as Collier, do you mind if I call you Collier, had his job. Now please, Colonel, can you give us the names of our men? That was already listed in Grishinov's voluminous notes. Your friends, you say? Yes, we are very grateful indeed for your efforts to keep them alive. They all have families, you know, just like you do. More coffee, Colonel? Yes, it is good coffee, isn't it? Of course you'll go home to your family. What do you think we are, barbarians? Grishinov had the good manners not to answer that one. Damn, Greer thought, but Bob is good at this sort of thing. It wasn't about courage or patriotism. It was about humanity. Grishinov was a tough hombre, probably a hell of a good airplane driver. What a shame they couldn't let Maxwell or especially Podolsky in on this. But he was at bottom a man, and the quality of his character worked against him. He didn't want the American prisoners to die. That, plus the stress of capture, plus the whiplash surprise of the cordial treatment, plus a lot of good brandy, all conspired to loosen his tongue. It helped a lot more that Ritter didn't even approach matters of grave concern to the Soviet state. Well, Colonel, I know you're not going to give up any secrets, so why ask?
Your man killed Vin, did he? The Russian asked halfway across the Pacific.
Yes, he did. It was an accident, and the Russian cut Ritter off with a wave.
Good.
He was Neku Turni, a vicious little fascist bastard. He wants to kill those men, murder them, Kolya added with the aid of 6 brandies. Well, Colonel, we are hoping to find a way to prevent that.
Neurosurgery West, the nurse said, trying to get Sandra O'Toole. Hold on, please. Sandy?
The nurse on desk duty held the phone up. The nursing team leader took it.
This is O'Toole.
Miss O'Toole, this is Barbara. We spoke earlier. Admiral Greer's office?
Yes. Admiral Greer told me to let you know. John is okay, and he's now on his way home.
Sandy's head spun around, to look in a direction where there were no eyes to see the sudden tears of relief. A mixed blessing, perhaps, but a blessing still.
Can you tell me when?
Sometime tomorrow, that's all I know.
Thank you.
Surely. The line went immediately dead.
Well, that's something.
Maybe a lot. She wondered what would happen when he got here, but at least he was coming back alive. More than Tim had managed to do. The hard landing at Hickam, the pilot was tired, startled Kelly into wakefulness. An Air Force sergeant gave him a friendly shake to make sure as the aircraft taxied to a remote part of the base for refueling and servicing. Kelly took the time to get out and walk around. The climate was warm here, but not the oppressive heat of Vietnam. It was American soil, and things were different here. Sure they are. Just once, just one time, he remembered saying. Yes, I'm going to get those other girls out just like I got Doris out. It shouldn't be all that hard. I'll get Bert next, and we'll talk. I'll even let the bastard go when I'm done, probably. I can't save the whole world, but by Jesus, I'll save some of it. He found a phone in the distinguished visitor's lounge and placed a call.
Hello,
the groggy voice said, 5,000 miles away. Hi, Sandy. It's John, he said with a smile. Even if those aviators weren't coming home just yet, well, he was, and he was grateful for that.
John, where are you?
Would you believe Hawaii?
You're okay?
A little tired, but yes, no holes or anything, he reported with a smile. Just the sound of her voice had brightened his day, but not for long.
John, there's a problem.
The sergeant at the reception desk saw the DV's face change. Then he turned back into the phone booth and became less interesting.
Okay, it must be Doris, Kelly said. I mean, only you and the docs know about me, and...
It wasn't us, Sandy assured him. Okay, please call Doris and... Be careful, but...
Warn her off?
Can you do that?
Yes.
Kelly tried to relax a little, almost succeeding. I'll be back in about, 9 or 10 hours. Will you be at work?
I have the day off.
Okay, Sandy. See you soon. Bye.
John,
she called urgently.
What?
Her voice stopped. Kelly smiled again. We can talk about that when I get there, honey. Maybe he wasn't just going home. Maybe he was going home to something. Kelly made a quick inventory of everything he'd done. He still had his converted pistol and other weapons on the boat, but everything he'd worn on every job, shoes, socks, outer clothing, even underwear, were now in whatever trash dump. He'd left behind no evidence that he knew of. The police might be interested in talking to him, fine. He did not have to talk to them. That was one of the nice things about the Constitution, Kelly thought as he walked back to the aircraft and trotted up the stairs. One flight crew found the beds just aft of the flight deck while the relief crew started engines. Kelly sat with the CIA officers. The Russian, he saw, was snoring loudly and blissfully. Ritter chuckled.
He's going to have one hell of a hangover.
What did you get into him?
Started off with good brandy, ended up with California stuff.
Brandy really messes me up the next day, Ritter said tiredly as the KC-135 started rolling. He was drinking a martini now that his prisoner was no longer able to answer questions.
So what's the story? Kelly asked.
Ritter explained what he knew. The camp had indeed been established as a bargaining chip for use with the Russians,
but it seemed that the Vietnamese had used that particular chip in a rather inefficient way, and were now thinking about eliminating it along with the prisoners.
You mean because of the raid?
Oh, God.
Correct. But settle down, Clark.
We got us a Russian, and that's a bargaining chip, too.
Mr. Clark, Ritter said with a tight smile, I like your style.
What do you mean?
Bringing that Russian in, you showed commendable initiative. And the way you blew the mission off, that showed good judgment.
Look, I didn't... I mean, I couldn't... You didn't screw up. Somebody else might have.
You made a quick decision, and it was the right decision. Interested in serving your country? Ritter asked, with an alcohol-aided smile of his own.
Sandy awoke at 6:30, which was late for her. She got her morning paper, started the coffee, and decided to stick to toast for breakfast, watching the kitchen wall clock and wondering how early she might call Pittsburgh. The lead story on the front page was the drug shooting. A police officer had gotten himself in a gunfight with a drug dealer. Well, good, she thought. 6 kilograms of pure heroin, the news piece said. That was a lot. She wondered if this was the same bunch that... No, the leader of that group was black. At least Doris had said so. Anyway, another druggie had left the face of the planet. Another look at the clock. Still too early for a civilized call. She went into the living room to switch on the TV. It was already a hot, lazy day. She'd been up late the night before and had difficulty getting back to sleep after John's call. She tried to watch the Today Show and didn't quite notice that her eyes were growing heavy. It was after 10 when her eyes opened back up. Angry with herself, she shook her head clear and went back to the kitchen. Doris's number was pinned next to the phone. She called and heard the phone ring. 4, 6, 10 times, without an answer. Damn, out shopping? Off to see Dr. Bryant? She'd try again in an hour. In the meantime, she'd try to figure out exactly what she would say. Might this be a crime? Was she obstructing justice? How deeply was she involved in this business? The thought came as an unpleasant surprise. But she was involved. She'd helped rescue this girl from a dangerous life, and she couldn't stop now. She'd just tell Doris not to hurt the people who had helped her, to be very, very careful. Please. Reverend Meyer came late. He'd been held up by a phone call at the parsonage and was in a profession where one couldn't say that he had to leave for an appointment. As he parked, he noticed a flower delivery truck heading up the hill. It turned right, disappearing from view as he took the parking place it had occupied a few doors up from the Brown House. He was a little worried as he locked his car. He had to persuade Doris to speak with his son. Peter had assured him that they'd be extremely careful. Yes, Pop, we can protect her. Now all he had to do was to get that message across to a frightened young woman and a father whose love had survived the most rigorous of tests. Well, he'd handled more delicate problems than this, the minister told himself, like short-stopping a few divorces. Negotiating treaties between nations could not be harder than saving a rocky marriage. Even so, the way up to the front porch seemed awfully steep, Meyer thought, holding the rail as he climbed up the chipped and worn concrete steps. There were a few buckets of paint on the porch. Perhaps Raymond was going to do his house now that it contained a family again. A good sign, Pastor Meyer thought as he pushed the button. He could hear the doorbell's two-tone chime. Raymond's white Ford was parked right here. He knew they were home. But no one came to the door. Well, maybe someone was dressing or in the bathroom, as often happened to everyone's embarrassment. He waited another minute or so, frowning as he pushed the button again. He was slow to note that the door wasn't quite closed all the way. You are a minister, he told himself, not a burglar. With a small degree of uneasiness, he pushed it open and stuck his head inside. Hello? Raymond? Doris? He called, loudly enough to be heard anywhere in the house. The TV was on, some mindless game show playing on the living room set. Hello! This was odd.
He stepped inside, somewhat embarrassed with himself for doing so, wondering what the problem was. There was a cigarette burning in an ashtray here, almost down to the filter, and the vertical trail of smoke was a clear warning that something was amiss. An ordinary citizen, possessed of his intelligence, would have withdrawn then, but Reverend Meyer was not ordinary. He saw a box of flowers on the rug, opened, long-stem roses inside. Roses were not made to lie on the floor. He remembered his military service just then, how unpleasant it had been, but how uplifting to attend the needs of men in the face of death. He wondered why that thought had sprung so clearly into his mind. Its sudden relevance started his heart racing. Meyer walked through the living room, quiet now, listening. He found the kitchen empty, too, a pot of water coming to boil on the stove, cups and tea bags on the kitchen table. The basement door was open as well, the light on. He couldn't stop now. He opened the door all the way and started down. He was halfway to the bottom when he saw their legs. Father and daughter were face down on the bare concrete floor, and the blood from their head wounds had pooled together on the uneven surface. The horror was immediate and overwhelming. His mouth dropped open with a sudden intake of breath as he looked down at two parishioners whose funeral he would officiate in 2 days' time. They were holding hands, he saw, father and daughter. They'd died together, but the consolation that this tragically afflicted family was now united with their God could not stop a scream of fury at those who had been in this home only 10 minutes earlier. Meyer recovered after a few seconds, continued down the stairs, and knelt, reaching down to touch the intertwined hands and entreating God to have mercy on their souls. Of that he had confidence. Perhaps she'd lost her life, but not her soul, Meyer would say over the bodies, and her father had reclaimed his daughter's love. He'd let his parishioners know that both had been saved, Meyer promised himself. Then it was time to call his son. The stolen flower truck was left in a supermarket parking lot. Two men got out and walked into the store, just to be careful, and out the back door, where their car was parked. They drove southeast onto the Pennsylvania Turnpike for the 3-hour trip back to Philadelphia. Maybe longer, the driver thought. They didn't want a state cop to stop them. Both men were $10,000 richer. They didn't know the story. They had no need to know.
Hello? Mr. Brown?
No, who's this?
This is Sandy. Is Mr. Brown there?
How do you know the Brown family?
Who is this? Sandy asked, looking out her kitchen window with alarm.
This is Sergeant Peter Meyer, Pittsburgh Police Department. Now who are you?
I'm the one who drove Doris back. What's the matter?
Your name, please?
Are they okay?
They appear to have been murdered, Meyer replied in a harshly patient way. Now I need to know your name and— Sandy brought her finger down on the switch, cutting the circuit before she could hear more. To hear more might force her to answer questions. Her legs were shaking, but there was a chair close by. Her eyes were wide. It wasn't possible, she told herself. How could anyone know where she was? Surely she hadn't called the people who— No, not possible, the nurse thought.
Why? She whispered the question aloud. Why?
She couldn't hurt anyone.
Yes, she could. But how did they find out?
They have the police infiltrated. She remembered the words from John's mouth. He was right, wasn't he? But that was a side issue.
Damn it, we saved her, Sandy told the kitchen.
Sandy could remember every minute of that nearly sleepless first week, and then the progress, the elation, the purest and best kind of professional satisfaction for a job well done, the joy of seeing the look in her dad's face. Gone. A waste of her time. No. Not a waste of time. That was her task in life, to make sick people well. She'd done that. She was proud of that. It was not wasted time. It was stolen time. Stolen time. 2 stolen lives. She started crying and had to go to the downstairs bathroom, grabbing tissue to wipe her eyes. Then she looked in the mirror. seeing eyes that she'd never beheld before. And seeing that, she truly understood. Disease was a dragon that she fought 40 hours or more per week. A skilled nurse and teacher who worked well with the surgeons on her unit, Sandra O'Toole fought those dragons in her way, with professionalism and kindness and